Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Homer's The Iliad, the great story of war at the gates of Troy, is filled with gruesome battle, horse and chariot, sword and shield, blood and sweat and death. It's also filled with tenderness, compassion for the enemy, for the essential human tragedy. A new translation makes it fresh, immediate, as relevant as ever. This hour on Point, Homer's The Iliad, made new. You can join the conversation. What have you taken from the great epic beneath the walls of Troy? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from Santa Barbara, California, is author, poet, and translator Stephen Mitchell, rock star translator. He's been called for his range and vigor. Gilgamesh, Genesis, the Bhagavad Gita, the Book of Job, the Gospel according to Jesus, the Tao Te Ching. He's done them all and more. Now, Homer's The Iliad. Stephen Mitchell, thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome, Tom.
I wonder if you could just, if you've got the book there, could you read just from the top of book one? We come in with the rage of Achilles and just, I don't know, just 9 or 10 lines there just so we can begin to get a feel right from the top of your new translation, Stephen.
Here's how it begins. The rage of Achilles. Sing it now, goddess. Sing through me the deadly rage that caused the Achaeans such grief and hurled down to Hades the souls of so many fighters, leaving their naked flesh to be eaten by dogs and carrion birds as the will of Zeus was accomplished. Begin at the time when bitter words first divided that king of men Agamemnon and godlike Achilles.
Stephen Mitchell from his new translation, and on it goes what god it was who caused the two men to clash, Apollo who took offense at the king and sent a deadly plague, and on. Remind us where we are in the story. People know the story, but of course the Iliad is not the whole story. It's not the Trojan horse. It's not the beginning when Helen is taken from Greece to Troy. The portion that the Iliad covers, not just in your translation, but in all, is what of this great ancient epic, Stephen?
Well, this poet whom we call Homer, but whose name we don't really know, is a very elegant poet and storyteller, as well as being one of the most brilliant and beautiful writers of verse, maybe the greatest poet ever to have lived and sung. So he chooses a very narrow slice of time at the end of the Trojan War. After 9 years, the Achaeans have been besieging the city of Troy for 9 years now, and he picks one incident at the end, an argument between the greatest hero of the Greeks or the Achaeans, Achilles, and the commander-in-chief, Agamemnon, and lets the story unfold from there. And he packs everything from those more than 9 years of war into the couple of weeks that this story takes place in. And it's a very elegant, brilliant presentation.
You are nothing if not bold in your choices of what to translate. I mean, the range of things that you've done, you know, from Rilke all the way back to Gilgamesh and the Bhagavad Gita to the Gospel according to Jesus. Talk about bold. But now you've come to the Iliad. I mean, you're translating some of the greatest works of all time. What about this work sets it apart? What's the perspective or the note in this, these sort of mountain peaks of human expression that you find in the Iliad?
Well, a friend of mine actually asked me why I had done it. He said, "You're such a peaceful fellow, and you've been working on these great sacred texts about peace of mind, peace of heart for all these years, and here's the great poem of war. What drew you to it?" I had to think about that for a little while, and after not too much thinking, it became apparent to me that there were two things. One is the sheer beauty of the language, just the privilege of hanging out for 3 years with the oceanic sound of Homer's Greek was an amazing experience. It was just more intense than I can possibly tell you. But the other part of it is that it was the privilege of hanging out with the vast mind of a poet who sees everything in human life and through the beauty of his language is able to raise even the most devastating of human experiences, which is the destruction of a city, the destruction really of a whole civilization, to raise that horror into the realm of beauty, to look at it unflinchingly with the heart wide open and see every aspect of the jewel of awareness from the agonizing death of a young man to the exhilaration of the other young man who's sticking a spear through his throat or his kidney.
This is Achilles and
Hector. It's an amazing experience of all-inclusive consciousness.
It does that, in your view, you write in your introduction, Stephen Mitchell, ultimately with a vision that is not only an aesthetic, but a moral one. You say you call the kind, that perspective embedded in here, love.
Well, for me, it is. It's the love that is another way of saying pure attention without moral judgment superimposed. It's a really powerful experience for us in our culture, which is so civilized in some ways, to be reading material this raw and not to want to sympathize entirely with the victim. But Homer doesn't see that the victim is any more beautiful or dignified or less dignified than the victor. He's really in the mind of both as the killing is taking place, as well as being in the mind of the villain and the hero and the people who are just going through pure suffering and the people who are going through the exhilaration of killing. It's everything. It's very shocking in many ways for us to enter a mind so free of moral judgments.
Almost, at least in some perspectives, almost a divine perspective on what's going on. You quote Goethe saying, "I'm always glad to return to the Iliad, for one is always lifted up by it, as if in a hot air balloon, above everything earthly, and one truly finds oneself in the realm where the gods soared to and fro." I wonder if you'd read from the introduction, you've got, just to get a sense of your language and the motion here, very early on in your introduction, you've got a ship sailing to Troy. Everybody who's gone to the movies and seen Troy or the many versions of it has some image of that vast fleet of ships headed across the Aegean from ancient Greece to what we now think of as Turkey and Troy. But could you read just that as the sails billow?
Sure. And it's a most beautiful passage, too. Very simple. "And as soon as the flush of dawn appeared in the heavens, they boarded the ship and launched her. Apollo sent them a favoring breeze, and they raised the mast, and they hoisted the white sail aloft, and it bellied out with the wind. And on either side of the ship's prow, the deep blue water sang out as the ship flew over the waves to her goal."
In the translation of Homer's The Iliad by Stephen Mitchell there, let's play back and forth if we can for a minute, Stephen. You go on then, describing a Trojan archer shooting an arrow. I'll read that bit. It says, "And laying the arrow's notched end in the ox-gut bowstring, he pulled it back with his right hand as far as his nipple, with the iron tip of the arrow touching the bow shaft, and the shaft was bent back, and he aimed, and then he let it go, and the great bow twanged, and the string sang out, and the arrow flew through the dense crowd, eager to find its mark." But then the intervention of the gods comes here. Can you read it, Stephen?
Mm-hmm. And that arrow, as we heard when you were reading that line, is conscious. I mean, it's alive, as so much in this poem is, from arrows and horses up to kings and queens. Yes, so the passage goes on. "But then Menelaus," the poet is speaking to one of the heroes of the poem, "but then Menelaus, the blessed gods did not forget you. Athena stepped out before you and with her hand deflected the deadly arrow, brushing it off as a mother brushes a fly from her sleeping child."
There's a tremendous tenderness here. It's unbelievable in the midst of all this war, and even to see the battle from the eye of the horse, of the horses pulling chariots. There's a bit here. Just so did the Trojan troops fall, and many horses pulled empty chariots that rattled across the plain, and they longed for their drivers. But these lay dead on the ground, far dearer now to the vultures than to their wives. It's all in the new translation of the Iliad by Stephen Mitchell. He joins us today from Santa Barbara. He's done Gilgamesh and the Bhagavad Gita and the Gospel according to Jesus and the Book of Job and Rilke and on and on. This is quite something. We want to come back and look more deeply at the work itself, Stephen Mitchell, and at how you go about doing this, how you go about creating this. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Talking this hour about Achilles and Hector and Helen of Troy, ancient Greeks, human nature, the gods, war, and a hot new translation of Homer's great epic, the Iliad. Stephen Mitchell has done it and joins us today from Santa Barbara, California. Stephen Mitchell, you write, it's that essential human tragedy that you found at the heart of this work as you translated it. How do you define that tragedy as Homer conveyed it?
Well, it's a tragedy, of course, in that there are there's massive suffering that is happening on the battlefield and is about to happen to a whole civilization. So in that sense, it's the great tragedy.
Somebody, because we know Troy will be pulled limb from limb when it is defeated. It will be crushed.
Yes. The whole city will be burned. All the men and boys and boy infants will be killed. And the women and girls will be taken into slavery. That's what happened in the ancient world. Not only in the ancient world, but yes. So it's a horror and a massive amount of suffering, and yet the art of the poet raises it to something that includes tragedy, but that is more than tragedy. There's a moment of grace at the end of the poem, which is so beautiful and deeply moving and unexpected. That it's unlike anything else in literature, really. It's the moment between the old king of Troy, Priam, mm-hmm. and the great Greek hero Achilles, who's personally slaughtered 30 or so of Priam's sons. And it's an amazing meeting of the heart between these two enemies at the end of the book. And probably, for me anyway, the most moving moment in all of literature.
You translate this moment, I don't know if you have it right before you there, but when these two come face to face, and there's a bit where he takes the old man's hand. Do you see that, Stephen?
Yes, yes.
Set it up for it. What's happening here? What's he begging? Priam is begging, and Achilles, who has the power of life and death entirely over him, as he has over so many of his sons at this point. What's being considered?
Yes, it's the end of the book, and Zeus, the king and father of the gods, has said basically enough already and has told Achilles that he was commanding him to let go of the dead body of Hector, the great Trojan hero, which Achilles has been mutilating out of his despair and guilt and
dragging it round
rage.
And round behind his chariot, behind the funeral pyre of his own great friend.
Exactly so. And so Priam, King Priam, is also commanded to go with a great ransom and ransom the body of his eldest son back from Achilles. So that's the setup for their meeting. And Priam appears guided by one of the gods into Achilles' camp and appears suddenly out of nowhere before the hero and falls at his feet and kisses his hand. And in his the final words of his great speech, he says, "Have pity on me. Remember your father, for I am more to be pitied than he is, since I have endured what no mortal ever endured. I have kissed the hands of the man who slaughtered my children." And then it goes on to say, in this moment of incredible tenderness, with these words, he stirred in Achilles a wild longing to weep for his father. Taking the old man's hand, he gently pushed him away, and each of them sat there, remembering. Priam, crouched at Achilles' feet, sobbed for Hector. Achilles wept, now for his father, now for Patroclus, and every room in the house rang with the sound of their mourning and lamentation.
That meeting between the king Priam and Achilles is just incredible, and reminds Achilles of his own father, and of course Achilles' mother, who was a goddess. And you talk about her, I mean, again and again in this story of war, there are these asides that are so tender, where you have one of your early readers on a New York subway car reading a printout of Book One, and she's so touched by this goddess, the motherly solicitude she feels when she hears Achilles' grief from the depths of the sea. And in her translation, you write, at once she arose like a mist from the gray waters, and sat down before him, Achilles, and listened to him as he wept and stroked his hair and spoke to him softly, "Child, why are you weeping? What has caused you this sorrow?" The movies show us the chariots and the swords and the spears, and they are all there, but there's much more in the Iliad. Stephen Mitchell brings us to it in a new translation. Joins us from Santa Barbara, California. We have lots of callers. Glenn in Springfield, Massachusetts. Thanks for calling, Glenn. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking the call. Mm-hmm. And you'd asked what, moved us. And in the last scene you're talking about, when Priam's with Achilles and they are both at that point, they're both tender. It's just an incredible moment. It's not the first time I read it, but it's why the Iliad follows round. And as a little counterpoint, there's a big storm of sails around one of these action games that are one of these war games recently that was released, all the sails, and you can go through that. There's no sense of human compassion, none. And these literary treasures, it's nice that they get the work gets done. And I have read also Gilgamesh by Mr. Mitchell, and it's just a treasure to push them out into the public, which unfortunately is so future oriented. So I just wanted to say that was my moving piece in that, but also how important this work is, because this is one historical, non-historical culture oriented, so future oriented. We stand in danger of forgetting our humanity.
Watch out for the video game version of everything. Glenn, I appreciate that very much. And let me get one more. Cassie in Lexington, Kentucky. Cassie, you're on the air with Stephen Mitchell.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I wanted to say I read the Iliad in college, and the thing that I remember and the thing that really stood out to me was the lack of irony compared to modern literature. And I think when you talk about the God's eye view of it, that's what really stands out to me, is God isn't trying to trick us into feeling one way and then showing us something else. It's just accepting the way things are, and I think that's honest and very beautiful.
A directness. Stephen Mitchell, what do you say to that observation?
Well, I agree. The style of Homer is combines a very beautiful simplicity, which can speak to people of all ages, all educational levels, and to the very simple as well as the very sophisticated. That's one of the qualities of his style, that simplicity and directness of language and of thought. It's also very fast. It tells a lot in an amazingly short amount of time, and so you get a great deal of human experience as well as beauty packed into even a short passage, as some of your listeners might have been able to hear.
And Cassie says it also is without, I mean, the gods can be tricky, but it's not exactly with the irony that we've come to expect in contemporary literature.
No, it's not in the voice, at least certainly not in the same way. There are ironies, but it's seeing things directly from many angles and always with great openness of heart as I read it.
Let's go to Juliana in North Andover, Massachusetts. Juliana, thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me. Mm-hmm. I was just wondering about the about how Mr. Mitchell approaches being literal with the poetics and meters in Greek versus appealing to a modern audience.
Yeah, let's begin to go into that. I mean, how did you approach this task, Stephen?
Well, that's an interesting question. I would first of all do all my homework and read all the commentaries and the textual apparatus, and that is gets pretty detailed and complicated. But when I had a thorough sense of what was going on, I would start listening, and this could take anywhere from 5 minutes to a half hour to have the equivalent English sound in my ear as I was reading the Greek sound. The Greek sound is this oceanic, gorgeous, infinitely varied meter. And I was hearing a similar meter in English, a five-beat line that is very supple and also capable of telling a story. So I would listen, and until I heard that rhythm begin to start up in one of my ears, and then in the other ear I would hold the literal sense, and somehow magically to me these two strands of polyphony would come together, and I would be able to write a first draft in the meter. And then it took me another 5 to 40 drafts to get it really fine-tuned. But once the first draft was written, essentially it was done.
You've got all kinds of praise for this translation, some reservations as well, but how does it work? You've translated in so many languages. I mean, this is not a language, Homer's Greek, in which you're fluent. So how does that work?
Well, nobody speaks ancient Greek, mm-hmm. And a lot of people read ancient Greek. It's not that difficult a kind of Greek compared to certain other Greek authors. You can learn it pretty well if you give your attention to it within a year or so. And so, I began the project with Greek that was a bit shaky, and by the end it was much more solid. But I began knowing enough to know that I could dive in and learn what I needed to learn in the process of translating. I've had a lot of experience with this, and it was an absolute joy. It was just an ecstatic experience plunging into this consciousness and this music and staying there for hours and hours and hours every day of the week.
Mm. Matthew Arnold, the great scholar, you say, was your guide in all this, in his writing, saying that the translator of Homer should above all be penetrated by a sense of the four qualities of his author, Homer, which he describes as Homer's prose are rapid, plain, direct, and noble. Stephen Mitchell has just brought out a new translation of the Iliad. He joins us from Santa Barbara, California. Stephen, please stand by. Joining us as well right now from Barrytown, New York, is James Rahm, professor of classics at Bard College, who has written glowingly of this work, knows the classics very well, and we're delighted to have him with us. James Rahm, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Tom.
You've written in a very laudatory terms of this new translation, but it does break ground in new ways, not only by what's there, but what's not there, James.
Yes, that's right. Stephen Mitchell has produced a beautiful work of poetry, just staggeringly beautiful lines, and a great ear for Homer's music. And he's also made some bold choices about the text of Homer.
Describe those.
Well, he's followed the work of a recent scholar, Martin West, who believes that Book 10 of the Iliad is not original to the poem, and many other individual lines and passages are not part of the original poem, and so Stephen Mitchell has left those out from his version, which is a controversial choice, but a very interesting one.
And Stephen Mitchell, not only Book 10 have you left out, but West has noted different passages and lines with a different sense of what may have been original, whatever that means, and those which appear additions you also have largely swept aside, Stephen.
Yes, I think that this Oxford scholar, Martin West, is one of the great, if not the greatest, textual scholar we've ever had. And so I was very confident in trusting his choices. Whether or not he's right isn't the point. We've had every translation up till now has been a translation of the received text. And I don't want to get into technicalities, but we've already had lots of versions of what has come down to us through the Middle Ages. I wanted to give the benefit of the doubt to Professor West. I don't have many doubts about it, but and see what kind of Iliad came out when you do eliminate these texts that possibly or even probably were not original to the original poet. And to my mind, a much tauter and more dramatic and more beautiful poem comes out of it.
James Rahm, what about it? Everyone celebrates how taught Stephen Mitchell's work here is, and there is, I mean, it goes at a great clip in the directness, something also not there from received versions. As a scholar, does that matter to you? How do you look at the different sort of presentations?
Well, yes, I think it matters a lot. I believe that Martin West is a very learned expert. He's studied this poem for decades, studied early Greek poetry for decades, and a translator can't have that expertise and has to trust one expert or another. These are deeply controversial matters in scholarship. You have two very different schools of thought about Homer, whether he wrote his poem or whether he was primarily a singer collecting oral tales. And Martin West believes that he's a writer, and I think he's right about that. And Stephen Mitchell has elected to follow that line. And I applaud him for following it all the way to its natural conclusion, which is that you have to leave out things that you don't think Homer wrote.
Stephen Mitchell, you've taken that as your guiding star as well here, that this wasn't just an oral tradition, that the Homer, whoever that was, actually wrote down and crafted the tale and poetry he wanted to pass on.
Well, as I understand Professor West's viewpoint, it wasn't necessarily that he wrote it down. He may have dictated it. We don't know and can never know. But his point in his very meticulous studies is that many elements in the text exhibit qualities that can only come from a written text. And if he's right in that, then it's a really good idea to leave out passages that are obviously inferior literarily and that very probably that look like they were spliced in from every element that we can tell.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Achilles and Hector and Helen of Troy, ancient Greeks, human nature, the gods, war, and a hot new translation of Homer's great epic, the Iliad. Stephen Mitchell has done it. It's the latest in a line of big-time translations that have him being called the rock star translator. Gilgamesh and the Bhagavad Gita, the Gospel according to Jesus, Rilke, and on now, the Iliad. He joins us today from Santa Barbara, California, and with us from Barrytown, New York, from Bard College, professor of classics there, James Rahm, also author of Ghost on the Throne, The Death of Alexander the Great and the War for Crown and Empire, knows this material so intimately and well. Many Americans, or globally these days, know the story, may know it from popular media. Here's a little bit from the 2004 film Troy. In this scene, the great Greek warrior Achilles, played by Brad Pitt, addresses his troops before they're about to launch an attack from the beaches of Troy.
Myrmidons, my brothers of the sword, I'd rather fight beside you than any army of thousands. Let no man forget how menacing we are. We are lions. Do you know what's there? Waiting beyond that beach. Immortality. Take it. It's yours.
There's the Hollywood sound. of a bit of the great ancient tale of the Trojan Wars. Stephen Mitchell, I wish just to get Homer back in our ears again before we go on. We read where Athena deflects the arrow there in your introduction, you excerpt from hitting Menelaus. But you go on to describe the Trojan army in a short passage there, after a day of what you remind us of sustained carnage, and they're camped out on the plain, dangerously close to the Achaean ships. And it's a wonderful translation that gives a sense of men and war, but also night and anticipation and the very earthy kind of descriptors that come to us in the Iliad. Could you read that for us?
Yes, it's a moment of such beautiful serenity. The eye of the hurricane, you could say. Here's how it goes. So, with elated hearts, they sat up all night on the battlefield, and their watchfires blazed all around them. As in the night sky, around the light of the moon, the stars emerge when the air is serene and windless, and the stars shine bright, and the heart of the shepherd rejoices. So before Ilion, the watchfires the Trojans had set blazed midway between the ships and the river Xanthus. 1,000 watchfires were burning upon the plain, and around each 50 men sat in the glow of the firelight, and the horses stood alongside the chariots, munching white barley and oats, and waited for dawn to arise.
Stephen Mitchell reading from his translation there of Homer's The Iliad. James Rahm, classic scholar at Bard, with us and listening. What about right there, Professor Rahm? I mean, I've read that a lot of Homer can sound more like King James than this more stripped-down, direct version that Stephen Mitchell brings us. Yet you laud it, but is it what you grew up with? Does it sound like what you want to hear in Homer, Professor?
Yes, it's a very natural musical line, and the language flows very freely. It's very up-to-date without being anachronistic. But there are other current translations that are like that. I mean, this is not an isolated case of updating of Homer. Homer has to be updated every few years, it seems, as our language keeps evolving, as our tastes evolve. But this one is particularly nice in its use of the five-beat line. Stephen Mitchell has had the courage to stick to a single meter throughout the entire Iliad, just as Homer used a single meter throughout his poem, and very few modern translators have done that.
Well, what about it? Stephen Mitchell presents this as kind of trying to go back to something closer to the original, however we conceive that. But here you are sort of praising him and others for following the evolution of our tastes. As a scholar, do you welcome the translations that follow our tastes as opposed to what was? Or what is that interchange supposed to be, James?
Well, I think a good analogy is with the conductor of classical music. A translator is sort of like a conductor of a symphony orchestra. And as we know from recordings of great works of music, they keep evolving. The interpretations change with the times, and every new generation produces a new Don Giovanni, a new Beethoven's Ninth, according to the way that generation hears music. And I think the same is true of language.
It's amazing. Abby in East Reigate, Vermont, is calling. Hi, Abby. You're on the air with Stephen Mitchell and James Rahm.
Hi, Tom. I love your shows, by the way. I just have a quick question for Mr. Mitchell. And he used the term oceanic to describe the poem. And I don't know if he meant that in Greek there's a kind of wave-like meter to the language or the scope of the poem. I didn't know what he meant by oceanic, and I'm very interested to know that.
One of my favorite words. Thank you, Abby. Stephen, what do you mean?
All of the above. So it's vast like the ocean. It's wave-like. It has a... It has a recurrent kind of rhythm the meter's the same in every line, but the rhythm is incredibly varied from line to line, so that there's a combination of regularity and constant surprise that I've tried to recreate to the best of my ability in English.
You also talk and demonstrate very often, as you can't avoid it in the Iliad, Homer's what you call his intense noticing. We heard it there, where the Trojan troops are camped overnight, and they're waiting with that sort of warrior's anticipation for dawn. The horses are munching their white oats. They're seeing stars in a way, Homer tells us, as shepherds would look at stars, when stars become so important when it's emptiness otherwise around. Give us some other examples of that intense noticing that's interwoven with the elements of war.
Well, here's one that I really love, and that is, it only takes place in five lines or so of the poem, but it's one of those moments of noticing that is heartbreaking, and yet it's not a sad moment as we read it. It's deeply moving and filled with compassion and beauty, and it's something beyond heartbreaking. But here's how it goes: one of the Greek warriors aims at Hector and misses him and kills a young Trojan prince named Gorgythion. So Homer says, he missed him and hit Gorgythion in the chest, Priam's son, by a wife who came from Issyme, Castianira, as beautiful as a goddess. And his head drooped like a poppy in a spring garden, weighed down with seeds and a heavy rain. So his head leaned to one side beneath the weight of his helmet. And in that moment of this young man dying and his head falling to the side with his heavy bronze helmet, there's that motion of the poppy leaning its head down, heavy with rain, that is superimposed onto the head of that young Trojan man in such an intimate, beautiful, and as I said, heartbreaking, and yet not heartbreaking way, that it's a moment of great wonder reading it.
That the head with the heavy bronze helmet and drooping like a poppy in a spring garden. James Rahm, you're our scholar of...
One thought?
Yes, please.
I just wanted to mention another feature of Mr. Mitchell's translation that is unique is the names have stress marks to show how they're pronounced, which is a remarkable improvement. If a reader is coming to the name Gorgythion for the first time,
yeah. You
would have no idea how to pronounce it, but the simple placing of a stress mark helps enormously.
Yes, and it gives us a way to voice it in our minds and not just glide over what might look too intimidating otherwise.
Exactly.
Athens, Georgia calling. Barry. Barry, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hello, sir.
Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
I just wanted to, I'm 67, and I have a PhD in cell biology, and I was a biology major in college. But the best course I ever took in college was in classics. With an incredibly magical professor who really lit up my life every time I took the class. And I just wanted to say that liberal arts education seems to be an endangered species these days. And I'm really glad to see this new translation. I'm really glad to hear that it's probably going to be more accessible. I'm going to buy it. And I applaud the author, and I really hope maybe this helps just a little in fostering a liberal arts education.
Amen to that, Barry, and I appreciate your call from Athens, Georgia. So many moments in this translation. Here's Hector talking about, he says he knows about fighting. I mean, certainly we've had enough men and women fighting to be in the heart of this, and Stephen Mitchell brings us to it. It's from the Iliad. He says, I know how to kill a man. I know how to swing my shield to the right or left. I know how to charge straight into the frenzy of chariots, attacking or fleeing in terror, and I know how to step in the deadly dance of hand-to-hand combat. That heightened sense of aliveness right there, Stephen Mitchell, in those lines.
Yes, this is one of the instances where the reader not only can enter into the experience of the pain of the victim, but into the intense exhilaration of the victor. It can be a really unsettling experience at first. There's even a Greek word specifically for the joy of entering a battle, and this is a part of human experience that most of us don't know, and that through our imaginative entry into this great poem, we can include as part of our understanding about how the human race has been and how it's gotten to where it has.
The joy of battle, but also the horror of it, the tragedy at loss. James Rahm, in your reading of this today, I mean, you look out on our culture and our time. What do you think is most important for us to take from the Iliad after all these thousands of years?
Well, the Iliad often gets cast as a poem of war, and I think Stephen Mitchell has helped bring out the fact that it's really a poem of the world. It's a poem about human beings, relationships, the mortal condition, the human condition. And because war has such a problematic aspect to it for us nowadays and is unfamiliar to most of us in our own experience, it would be a mistake to think that this is just a poem of war and dismiss it. It's really about a world and about human beings.
And yet war right in the middle of it, there's the moment where Achilles charges Hector when they're battling. And in Stephen Mitchell's translation, it's incredible. He's talking about the tip of his Achilles spear, like the evening star as it shines among other stars in the depths of the night, the loveliest star in the heavens. Such was the gleam from the point of Achilles' spear as he held it in his right hand, determined to cut down Hector, scanning his armor, looking for bare skin. The rest of his body was covered in bronze. In only one spot could the flesh be seen on his throat, where the collarbone separates neck from shoulders. At this spot, as Hector attacked, Achilles thrust, and the spear drove into the tender flesh of the neck and pushed all the way through, though it did not sever his windpipe. And there's a conversation that ensues. Josh in West Hartford, Connecticut.
Hi, Tom. You asked whether the Iliad still moves us, and actually just last week when I was driving back from visiting family in Boston with my wife and two kids, my sons, who were 7 and 4, wanted me to tell them the story, and I was at a loss for anything original, so I tried to tell them the Iliad as best as I could remember it.
Brave, good you.
Nearly 20 years ago. And it took over an hour, and I'm sure I didn't do it half the justice or a fraction of the justice that Professor Mitchell has, but they were riveted. So it definitely still moves.
Still moves. I love it, Josh. Thank you so much for that. And Mara, calling from Ithaca, no less, New York. Mara, thanks. You're on the air.
Hi. Just wanted to call in and say that, yes, this is a 22-year-old person. The Iliad does still move me. I just went to Greece and walked around to try and get more of a sense of it. And I have to say that I heard you just express that you don't think it's an oral poem, but all the epithets that made Lord and Perry actually think it was an oral poem in the first place make a lot more sense once you walk around in the landscape.
And feel it in your bones. Mara, thanks for that. You know, Daniel Mendelssohn wrote about your translation in The New Yorker, Stephen, and I put this to James as well. He's, you know, kind of likes the old school translation. And he said, James, I'll come first to you. Mendelssohn wrote, the Iliad doesn't need to be modernized, because the question it raises is a modern, indeed existentialist one. How do we fill our short lives with meaning? What about that notion, James Rahm, first to you, that the Iliad doesn't need modernizing?
Well, I take him to mean that the themes and the content of the poem are timeless, and they have as much resonance for us today as for the ancient Greeks. I don't think he was saying that the language doesn't need modernizing, because he himself has translated Greek poetry and done so beautifully. He knows that every poem needs to have a new voice for a new generation. So I think he's talking more about the content, and that's, of course, universal.
He may be leaning even past the content. I mean, you read it, Stephen. I know you responded. You said, to me, the additions that came were like the accumulation of grime, touch-up attempts, and yellowing varnish on a Renaissance masterpiece. You've stripped some of that away. Our time grows short. What do you hope people find in this translation, Stephen, that will bring it afresh?
Well, I hope that they have something of the experience that Goethe had with the Iliad, of great exhilaration, like looking at the world of human affairs from a God's eye point of view. That's my experience, and the experience of I think, many thousands of readers. It's just an amazing, exhilarating, gorgeous experience to enter into this, the great mind of this poet.
above, that God's eye view may be above the woe of war, not apart from it, but seeing it whole. It is tremendous in itself, and it's really wonderful to read this new version. Stephen Mitchell, we're very grateful to you for being with us today. Thank you so much for joining us from Santa Barbara.
It was my pleasure.
Stephen Mitchell, translator of the new The Iliad, and James Rahm, who's just been out with his book, Ghost on the Throne, at Bard College, professor of classics there. Thank you for joining us today, Professor Rahm.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, lots of interesting comments online. Hope you'll check them out. And thanks for joining us in this wonderful epic from ages past. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.